Thank you much. I'm gonna find the water first. A couple of years ago, I learned to drink out of bottles. I'd never really learned, and I didn't know you were supposed to leave room for air. And I'm serious. I mean, I was 53 years old when I learned. So we're all capable of intellectual advances. I don't know why I wanted to start with this poem. It's a private poem, but one of the things that I loved as a child, and there weren't all that many, was my grandparents' mattress. They had a feather mattress, and it seemed very magical to me, and I always bluffed to run and just leap as high as I could and fall on the mattress. And when they died, the mattress came to me, and it's not that it had lost its magic, but it just lay around for a long time, and at some point, I had all of these jigs that I was fishing for crappie with, and they wore their feathers off, and they seemed magical to me. And so I cut it open. I cut open the mattress and got the feathers to put back on the jigs, glued them on, and it worked very well, but I always felt a great guilt for that. It's like they turned over in their graves. I was thinking, you know, there were great erotic experiences on the bed. So this is called Family Mattress. It's in a permanent slump now, dry docked in the attic, an old dream-battered Ralph striped as a convict. But how high it lay mornings when I stole in to drift down the resilient ether of its cloud, as though a schooner broke from the clods of a field I had been hoeing, or I found among promises never delivered the risible helium of the soul that woke in sudden divings and spinnings. Here too, my grandparents fell back swooning, white-shouldered in the mercy of wings, after conceiving my father and aunt. To heft it now and wear it through the door is to feel the weight of their weightlessness. A coop smell rises. I'm draped in myth and the dried tallows and yeasts of tradition. But set it on the floor. They will not mind who taught me music and setting hooks when I rip back the ticking to feather jigs. And this is a related kind of thing that I saw today. I've always been afraid of heights, and it's been fortunate that I was as short as I am, I guess. You search and you find ways to go home. But for a long time, I had repetitive dreams that involved my flying. They would begin often with my dunking a basketball, which just feels wonderful, even if it is a dream. As they evolved, I began to, for some reason, steal airplanes. And though I didn't know how to fly and I was afraid of heights, I always felt such joy, and I thought, how will I land it? Because I feel like I could take off. Landing is another thing. And it's just the sense of weightlessness that I've always liked. It's called common law kundalini. A sudden loving settles into your own weight, click, then roll over onto your back, and you are there above yourself, the human spirit in full cloud drift, a lust field stripped to eye and ambition, which moves through walls and doors and rises to the carnival of looking down with no power but that of seeing all of it momentarily unchangeable, the shadow-tenciled moonlit fields and silvery water towers on stilts, the vole and the unblinking talon of the owl. Even better, asleep in dream buoyancy, I've seen more than I ever saw pretzel munching in some cloud valley 30,000 feet above the sorghum. Once a pelican stopped to question me. Once my friend Herbert Maccabee bumped into me out of the mist with a talking sheep under his arm. Often I have achieved much in basketball, for many dream flights launched from the magic floor of some actual gym where old men smoked by a pot-bellied stove, but removed from time, unblocked, and watched by sweethearts, cheered, I rose and donked and hovered with fear's iodine in my throat. When I'm up there, it is not poetry. And the dream's onlyness, it feels wingless, bird elegant, experimental, requiring the decisionless decision-making of dreams. But somehow, why'd I do this if not for the freedom? Sometimes I wish I had never heard of the name of Sigmund Freud. My grandparents had two workhorses, great workhorses that they used. They both lived to be over 30. The gelding was named Charlie and the mare was named Nell. And they meant something. For some reason, I always looked at horses as kind of gender examples. It was strange because, in general, mares are more temperamental than stallions, unless mares are in heat around, at which point they become very temperamental. But I hope this is not about my own marriage. It's called Nell. Not until my father had led her into the paddock and driven her a month in circles and made her walk 6 weeks with the collar on her neck and the bags of seeds on her back did he snap the leather traces to the hames. For she was not green Halderbroke when he took her that way, rearing and shying at each bird call of shadow. It would be another year in blinders before she began seeing how it would go from then on. Moving as not as herself alone, but as one of a pair, with the sorrel gelding of the same general conformation and breed shuffling beside her, and between them only the split tongue of the wagon, as is often the case with couples, he the subdued philosophical one, and she with the great spirit and the preternatural knack of opening gates. They had barely become a team when the beasts began vanishing from the fields, and the fields one by one fell before the contagion of houses. Still, they were there for a long time after the first tractors and the testing of rockets, so you could see how it had been that way for years with them, just the one motion again and again, until at dusk when the harnesses were lifted, the odor that rose seemed history itself, and they bent to their feed in the light that would be that way for the rest of their lives. Early on, when I moved to the place where I've lived for the last 10,000 years, for some reason I began meditating on thinking about mules. This is sort of a symbolic mule. I can't determine if it's a self-portrait or it's the winged beast of poesy, Pegasus, or whatever, but it was called Mule. I'm trying to think of something to tell you about mules that you don't know, but then why would you care, you know? Mule. Here is this horse from a bad family, hating his burden and snaffle, not patient so much as resigned to his towpath around the sorghum mill, but pawing the grist, laying back his missile ears to balk, so the single spoke of his wheel freezes, the gears lock. Not sad, but stubborn. His temperament is tolerance, though his voice, old door aching on a rusty hinge, blasts the martens from their gourds. And he would let nothing go behind him, the speckled hen, the green world his blinders magnify. With the heel of one ecclesiastical hoof, he would stun goats or gods. Half-ass, garrulous priest, his religion's a hybrid appetite that feasts on contradictions. In him, Jefferson dreamed the end of slavery and endless fields, but the labor goes on in prefabricated barns by stalled regiments of canopied tractors in offices where the harvest is computed to the least decimal point, to the last brown bowl of wheat. Not with him. The soil yields and futures swell under the radio. His place finally is to be loved as a curiosity, as an art almost dead, like this sulfurous creek of molasses he brings oozing down from the bundles of cane. Sometimes in the library I pause suddenly and think of the mule, desiring perhaps some lost sweetness, some fitful husk or buttercup that blooms wildly beyond the margins. Such a peace comes over the even rows, the bound volumes where the unicorn bows his unearthly head, where the horned gods of fecundity rear in the pages of the sun. All afternoon I will think of the mule's dignity, of his shrunken lot, while the statistics slip the tattered net of my attention, while the lullabies erect their precise nest in the footnotes. I like to think of the silver one of my childhood and the dark red one, red. Avuncular, puritanical, he stands on hooves as blue as quarries, and I think his is the bray I have held back all of my life, in churches where the offering passed discreetly from one laborer to the next, in the factories of sleep, plunging a greased hand into the vat of mineral spirits. And I think I have understood nothing better than the mule's cruelty and petty meanness, how subjugated he will honk his incomparable impudent stop for no reason, or pastured with inferiors stomp a newborn calf on a whim. This is the mule's privilege, not to be governed badly by lashes, nor to be turned easily by praise, but sovereign of his own spirit, to take his own time, to meditate in the hardening compost under the rotting collars, to sleep in wet straw, to stand for nothing but himself. In August, he will stand up to his withers in the reeking pond. In the paradise of mules, he will stand with the old cows, contemplative, but brooding a little over the sores in his shoulders, remembering the dull shoes of the cultivator and the jet heads of the mowing machine. Being impotent and beautiful, he will dream of his useless romances. This is called the United States. I think it's an interesting country we live in. Borges said that Americans thought of themselves as soldiers, but that others in the world thought of them as traveling salesmen. And we think of ourselves as a great sort of innovative country full of, I guess, who knows what kind of people are in this country. But I do know that corn is here, and for some reason in this poem I've tried to focus on things that this country represented to me. And if you ask what it is all about, I would say a field, a green field, and the turning rows a killdeer, and after that barbed wire, the hedge with its cardinals, a blacktop, then another field. Corn, one of the main things after water and before milk, for whiskey is in it. And grits, gold for chickens, pearls before swine. There is a factory in every plant, if we could be properly humble. It is the greatness of the nation. Along with cartoon animation, automobiles, and rock and roll, jazz and basketball evolved here, but not one other U.S. god, just the corn's imperial row on row, then Sylvester Stallone and airbrushed Elvis. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Presley, Dylan, and the Supremes. No, I would say a field, a vast field. At the center, top hogs and cattle, then art. The cities, New York, Chicago, Houston, Seattle. Man told me last week experts can teach starlings to talk. Hell, televangelists may yet witness in Terzarima. Each stalk of corn contributes. It has been so hybridized with its immense ears it no longer resembles maize. It is what we have left to barter for oil and microchips, tons of it siloed and elevated to float us through droughts and wars and speculations. We ask which most cogently represents us, leaves of grass or the Simpsons. There is the idea that every living thing is a subset of human control, and the other notion that though we may go on a few hundred or thousand years, the poison has spilled, no more land will be made, the search for another arable planet may prove moot as the search for earthly sentience. Meanwhile, this taco here crunches in the great scheme of things. We persist, one people, one of the potential fates of corn. This is not a very uplifting poem, but I think it's honest. And I'm not sure if honesty can be uplifting, but at least it's something I've sworn not to be when I'm drinking. And I'm sober tonight, so perhaps this is mostly honest. I held a number of interesting jobs as a maintenance person, a dump truck driver, and a farm worker, and a factory worker. And then I went into a university, and over time it appears to me that the universities aren't quite the foreign countries that I once believed them to be. I think many of us came into a university in which there was not a mall in the student center. But soon there will be shoe stores. In my son's school, it's very hard to go a step without buying something. And for some reason, I want to drive the money lenders out of the temples of education. Having said that, this is called my monastery. I saw a good deal of life, then I went into the university. Hallways, laboratories, books of the desire to change government or art, very smart people, politically committed, involved with the latest theories, ambitious, but as they age, bitter, without purpose. What had I thought on entering? First, no more manual labor. Second, all those nubile girls at their maximum wildness and felicity. Also, the mean god of stupid people, the divine thug, bigot, xenophobe, executioner, and extortioner turned from the place in disgust. I heard many opinions expressed. The career pacifists, the Marxist castrati could not stop singing of the horrendous male ego. Finally, universities honored and sanctioned indigent forms of non-commercial crafts, the still-bearing crops of the obsolete arts. It was a great life among the scholars. Before that, I knew mainly working persons, pipe fitters, hairdressers. I saw most of the United States, then books, then interminable rooms of people staring into bright boxes. Before that, a smaller light shone. It came from short books into long silence. Then Boccaccio crawled from Eve's apple. Now if the golden vultures of Fox News will stop flapping their two right wings, I can watch the liberal arts die in peace. What are words? Words teach the soul to remember, and what is unknowable? Many philosophies rubbed against my ear. You've been brainwashed, my aunt said. She began that line when I learned the twist. Evil, she said, sin. I think of her now as my country lurches toward Baghdad, big, dumb, smug, murderous, and born again. One of the things that people enjoyed doing when I was a child was making fun of people with mental disabilities. And it's a hobby that never seems to cease. Occasionally we do something for which we feel guilty the rest of our lives. What I did here was, the person in this poem is called Wenton Bird, is not named Wenton Bird because it occurred to me that he might have relatives. So I changed the names. You know, probably I'll be sued anyway, right? But this kid was a 15-year-old fifth grader, and kids were held back then. Furthermore, in the spring operetta, they gave him the part of the caveman, a sensitive thing, you know, and he was dressed in a leopard skin suit. After the play, everybody was returning to their classrooms. I, too, was returning to the classroom, and I found a piece of angle iron that I was just looking at, and I, just out of the blue, I began hitting the stairs of the school with a piece of angle iron, and it made this really great jangling noise, the kind of thing that irritates my wife. But I've always enjoyed those sounds, musical instruments, and it just made this wonderful jangling noise. Jang! It just went on and on. And this kid that I call Wenton Bird came by, heard what I was doing, and he said, "That sounds good. Can I try that?" And I said, "Sure." And I gave him the angle iron, and he began to merrily hit the step too. And I went into the classroom and nobody was there. And I said, where is everybody? And the teacher said, well, the fire drill. I never mentioned it, what had happened. You know, I mean, I went out on the playground and I came back and I saw the principal leading this kid down the hall to the office. And it's a sad story. What are you going to do? It's just to prove that these poems are deep, that there's deep meaning behind them. Wenton and Mildred. Harlan Baker and Charles Palmer had Wenton Bird out in the drying asphalt of the new tennis court pretending to be a statue. And now as he began to struggle, they laughed and yelled, retard. Is that clear enough for you? Should I repeat it? In those days, they didn't socially promote you. You stayed in grammar school until you learned to spell Bull Connor or you died of arthritis. If it matters, some of us learned that some of the dead mattered and the rest stayed where shit belonged, inside quotation marks or italics. The intelligent were tricky. The stupid, natural surrealist. Good-natured provocateurs of laughter. Once when Wenton was a 15-year-old fifth grader dressed in a leopard skin suit to impersonate a caveman in the spring operetta, he came by the back steps of the junior high school where I was beating a piece of angle iron against the concrete and asked if he could try it. I led him then and went on up to the seventh grade classroom where John Tigg, professor of the facts of life, comportment, and hygiene, told me to go on outside. Didn't I hear the bell? There was a fire alarm. There was a fire alarm. And there came the truck. And there came the principal leading Wenton by his one spotted strout. Wenton was a twin, almost as good a thing to be as it was bad to be retarded. If you were slow, the angels of orthodox sensitivity you taught in the local public schools might, after reading The Tortoise and the Hare, assign you to the Turtles reading group. But they would not separate twins. Did you ever hear someone spell out something in front of you so you would not know what they were saying? When Wenton's sister Mildred was 14 and a fourth grader, she missed 87 consecutive days of school. And when she returned and the teacher asked what happened, she answered, I stubbed my toe. Mildred was not a pretty young woman, but she was pretty enough. I must be stupid too, because only today I figured out what probably happened and who was involved. I'm not saying who, I'm saying probably. We didn't have a television when I was a kid, so I learned to read. It was great, you know, but the truth is, given a choice, most of us will watch Boston Legal. You know, I mean, it's true, we're tired. We're tired people, all of it. You all look tired. You came to a poetry reading. What's wrong? I mean, what's on tonight? Let me see. Is the OC on tonight? No. In my community, because everyone else had television, I think, and it was very slow to arrive, we remembered the first people who got television and the way it was talked about. And I think the change it made, a profound change in the community, because before that, it was kind of like the fetus of the cell phone. You went to socials. We had socials every week, and people sat on the porches and talked and hollered at people who passed. The worst part about all of that, nobody will admit it, but every community in America except for three were packed with horrible musicians. And every social event was an attempt to batter your ears into musical surrender. And that was the truth for the most part. But still, I like the fact that people were interacting. So this is simple TV. All the preachers claimed it was Satan. Now the first set seemed more venerable than Abraham or Williamsburg or the avant-garde. Back then, nothing, not even the bomb, had ever looked so new. It seemed almost heretical watching it when we visited relatives in the city, secretly delighting but saying later after church, probably it would not last, it would destroy things, standards and the sacredness of words and books. It was well into the age of color, Korea and Little Rock long past before anyone got one. Suddenly, some of them in the next valley had one. You would know them by their lights burning late at night and the recentness and distance of events entering their talk. But not one in our valley. For a long time, no one had one. So when the first one arrived in the van from the furniture store and the men had set the box on the lawn, at first we stood back from it, circling it as they raised its antenna and staked in the guy wires before taking it in the door. And I seem to recall a kind of blue light flickering from inside, and then a woman calling out that they had got it tuned in, a little fuzzy, a ghost picture, but something that would stay with us, the way we hurried down the dirt road, the stars, the silence, then everyone disappearing into the houses. I always thought of this as a happy elegy, but one thinks abstractly of death. It can be a comforting thought. My most comforting thought was always of being sucked up into a tree and blossoming. But still, it would be terrible to be tickled by a bee then, wouldn't it? I mean, still, it was a good thought. So this was my thought of the afterlife, and I guess I wrote it after realizing that a friend of mine who's now involved in, as he calls it, priestcraft, he's a priest, his wife died, and it occurred to me that my thought about the afterlife was perhaps inadequate. So this is called Ground Sense. Because I have known many women who are dead, I try to think of fields as holy places. Whether we plow them or let them to weeds and sunlight, those are the best places for grief. If only that they perform the peace we come to, the feeling without fingers, the hearing without ears, the seeing without eyes. Isn't heaven just this unbearable presence under leaves? I had thought so. I had believed at times in a meadow and at other times in a wood where we'd emerge no longer ourselves but reduced to many small things that we could not presume to know. Except as my friend's wife begins to disappear, he feels no solvent in all the earth. And me, far off, still amateur at grief, walking the creek behind the house, I cross to the old home place, find a scattering of chimney rocks, the seeds my grandmother watered, the human lifetime of middle-aged trees. It seems to me often that people love to attack poetry, and it seems so vulnerable, and yet who cares, you know? You're free, you can write what you want. Nobody's going to read it anyway. So it's great in that way. And then there are the efforts to talk about poems in groups. I actually like reading alone. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. Poetry is a great friend, I think. But if you're talking in class, there's another way to talk about it, and I try not to pay attention to that. But the other thought that you have if you've devoted your life to poetry is that poetry isn't terribly important to most people, and that journalists just hate poets. I don't know why, but almost all journalists hate poets. You know, it's what have we done? As do professors of literature. But, you know, like, I was like a local kid in Alabama, and I was from out in the country, and I knew there was another world. I was always reading, so I was kind of living in that world of reading. My only connection to the ground was like sex and football. But reading, I thought there was another world. And for some reason, I formed the illusion that outside the South, all the people were writers. I know that's stupid, but there's a line in here where I go outside the South, and I remember this stopping in a truck stop, and I thought, is that Ann Sexton? You know, and it was like, I just thought, oh, of course, that's where they're at. A defense of poetry. If abstract identity, philosophy silhouette, authorless, quoted, and italicized, governs by committee the moments of a mutinying, multitudinous self, then I'm lost. But let a semi loaded with bridge girders come barreling down on me, I'm in a nanosecond propelled into the singular, fleet and unequivocal as a deer's thought. As to the relevance of poetry in our time, I delay and listen to the distances. John Fay's West Coast Blues, a truck backing up, hammers, crows in their perennial discussion of moles. My rage began at 40. The unstirred person, the third person void, the you of accusations and reprisals visited me. Many nights we sang together, you don't even exist. In print, a little later is the closest we come to now. The turn in the line ahead and behind, the voice slower than the brain and the brain slower than the black chanterelle. The first time I left the South, I thought I sighted in an Indiana truck stop both Ann Sexton and John Frederick Nims. But poetry makes a little dent like a dart. It's the solo most hold inside the breath as indigestible truth. For backup singers, there's the mumbling of the absolutes. Doobop of rain and kinking heat, la-la of oblivion, sheep bleat and stone shift and pack choir. There is a sense beyond words that runs through them. Animal evidence like fur in a fence, especially valuable now, self-visited as we are, self-celebrated, self-ameliorated, and self-sustained with the very kit of our inner weathers, with migraine, our pain de jour, our bread of suffering. If poetry is no good to you, why pretend it can enlighten you? Why trouble the things you have heard or seen written when you can look at the madrone tree? I'd like to read a poem about a bad attitude, I guess. It's kind of about being a Democrat, but it's not about being a Democrat either. I think anybody who grows up working close to a tennis court, if you've got a job close to a tennis court, it's kind of like the social situation. You're sitting there with like a drill, you know, beating it on, and there are these people. And you're going, man, that Marks guy, he had something going on, you know. I mean, this is, and I don't mean it in a good way. I mean, you ought to be able to get over those things, you know. I mean, it's important to love rich people, I think, you know. I mean, because they have good dentistry, and it's important, but this is called the attitude. We who have towed the burden cherished kinship. We ditch diggers and box toters, we hammers and assemblers. No matter if we work now as architects or engineers, if we enter a room primed with statistics or quote Levi Strauss to a graduate seminar, we feel the boss lurking in the aisles between the machines. No, we will say if you ask, nothing is wrong. Unless we are dying, the doctor is our enemy. If we have ever crawled into a cold furnace with a hacksaw or squeegeed into a manhole or perched over a river tying steel or gouged septic gums with spit sucker or stripped the sheets from the birthing bed or shackled the mat onto a gurney or staggered from a fire ripping at a mask, do not speak to us of Tasmanian emeralds, our libraries in Korea. We would prefer hearing what comes easy. The power glide at the core of the transmission, the prophet that greases the laws into being. Rich and beloved, we remain shitheads. Before birth, we were cheated by slag pits and rhetoric and mosquitoes. Do not write of us, we will not read it. Write the prescription that will make us gentle. The trucks are empty, the boxes are full. Show us what help means. I'd like to read a poem that I spent a lot of time thinking about, which probably isn't much of a poem, but we seem to be in a new era of psychological terror. This poem ended up being called Fears. To begin with, it was about flat characters. I mean, the characters who have to remain flat for the novel to go on. And sometimes we are those characters, and sometimes we are the flat characters in other people's novels. And sometimes offended, but it occurs to me that many of the people that we have vilified at this point in time have been those flat characters. So it's sort of a personification of fear, and it's sort of about terrorism, and I don't know how you will read it. Fears. They are like clouds on days when there are no clouds, are flat characters in works of fiction. We go past them knowing that they stand near, breathing but not fully vested, hovering just shy of the third dimension, traced lightly in pencil. That they may have saved us once from childhood embarrassment, or cauterized an ideal with a kiss, in no way qualifies them for perennial attention. Go past, turn the page with a decided swish. But as they live, I vouch for them, the anonymous, the invisible, those who have lost everything. For them, the bombs are not real. They believe only in history. They have no impression that they leave an impression. Early in my life, I was raised by very good Christians. I don't know what happened to me, but I was really taught sort of turn the other cheek and raised by very pacifist people and pretty much taught not to fight. And taught that the central message of Christianity, for instance, was peace. And yet, at the same time, it's just so hard to love some people when you think about it. You know, I mean, and you know, you extend that Christian thought to some kind of cosmic plane, and you think, "Good virus, I love you, virus." And no, you don't love the virus, but. At some point, I was sitting with a mosquito on my arm as a grown man and still indulging this thought. It's probably a little unit of consciousness there, you know. You know, you just can't be that good. The mosquito. I see the mosquito kneeling on the soft underside of my arm, kneeling like a fruit picker. Kneeling like an old woman with the proboscis of her prayer buried in the idea of God. And I know we shall not speak with the aliens and that peace will not happen in my life. Not unless it is in the burnt oil spreading across the surfaces of ponds, and the dark egg rafts clotting and the wiggle tails expiring like batteries. Bring a little alcohol and a little balm for these poppies planted by the Queen of Neptune. In her photograph, she is bearded and spurred, embellished 500 times, her modular legs crouching, her insufferable head unlocking to lower the razor edge of its tubes. And she is there in the afternoon when the wind gives up the spirit of cleanliness and there rises from the sound the brackish oyster and squid smell of creation. I lie down in the sleeping bag sodden with rain. Nights with her, I am loved for myself, for the succulent flange of my upper lip, the twin bellies of my eyelids. She adores the easy, the soft. She picks the tenderest blossoms of insomnia. Mornings, while the jackhammer rips the pavement outside my window, while the sanitation workers bang the cans against the big truck and shout to each other over the motor, I watch her strut like an udder with my blood, imagining the luminous pick descending into Trotsky's skull. And the 11 days I waited for the cold chill nightmare and night sweat of malaria, imagining the mating call and the vibrations of her wings, and imagining in the simple nod of her ganglia how she thrills to my life, how she sings for the harvest. This will be the last poem, and I wanted to say one of my earliest feelings of power was just my absolute adoration for rain and rainstorms. And grandmother had an open front porch, and as a little kid, she always had like an old blanket that dogs had been sleeping on. But anything may be used. When a rain is coming and the cold air starts coming, there's a point to where you can actually sort of train the goosebumps on your body, with a blanket. You know, when the cold comes, you feel the goosebumps going up, and you just get a little blanket and you let them go down a little ways and then take it away and they go back up. And you feel you're in utter control of some great sensual pleasure. So that's where this poem's coming from. Rain on Tin. If I ever get over the bodies of women, I'm going to think of the rain, of waiting under the eaves of an old house at that moment when it takes a form like fog. It makes the mountain vanish. Then the smell of rain, which is the smell of the earth a plow turns up, only condensed and refined. Almost 50 years since thunder rolled and the nerves woke like secret agents under the skin. Brazil is where I wanted to live. The border is not far from here. Lonely and grateful would be my way to the end. And something for the pain, please, a little purity to sand the roughed edges, a slow downpour from the dark ages, a drizzle from the Pleistocene. As I dream of the rain's long body, I will eliminate from mind all the qualities that rain deletes, and then I will be primed to study rain's power, the first drops lightly hallowing, but now and again a great gallop of the horse of rain, or an explosion of orange-green light, a simple radiance. It requires no discipline. Before I knew women, I knew the lonely pleasures of rain, the mist and then the clearing. I will listen where the lightning thrills the rooster up a willow, and my whole life flowing until I have no choice, only the rain, and I step into it. Thank you.